This is MR Radio, I'm GW. Today, I and Daniel S. will be talking to Jan the White Uniter. And he has a new organization, which is United White. I say it's new because at the moment the website is still incomplete. I've been reading it to get a real good lowdown on the whole thing, but I think it's much better to actually talk to the man himself. He has a long and interesting history, and Daniel's going to be talking about that, his background, his awakenings, influences, and a lot more, the organization itself, of course, and his general take on European history, which is something which is a hot topic at the moment at MR. So I invite you to listen. I will now step aside, and Daniel will start the ball rolling. Daniel, thanks very much.
Thank you, UW. So today we have Jan the White Uniter here with us. It's my pleasure to speak with him, particularly as he is a man with a long background in white activism, and that's where I'd like to begin. Jan, would you tell us something about your background in white activism?
Well, I guess you could say that I'm in my middle ages right now. I have two school-age white children who need a future, and under this current Semitic white genocidal system, they have no future, so therefore I have to stand up for them and for all those other white children who likewise need a future.
But your awakening to that, the necessity of that, happened quite a while ago.
Well, certainly. I've had many experiences which pushed me into the situation where I'm at. Perhaps my views weren't as articulate or well-polished or even ethno-nationalist as they are now. I've been gradually moving in that direction in the past couple years because I find it is the most moral of positions of all. But my... the opinions I hold go back for many years. For example, I remember when I was much younger, when I was actually in the Army when this happened in California, believe it or not, when we had these Rodney King riots. Wasn't that in 1991, I believe? Yeah, it was.
Somewhere around there.
Yes. And we remember all the media talk about this, and I was about 300 miles north of Los Angeles when these riots went down and one of the violence happened, and kind of being the eternal tourist that I am, I wanted to go in there and survey the war zone, as they made it out to be on TV, kind of like a new Beirut. So I drove down there the weekend after the riots were over to South Central LA. I was actually looking for the corner where Reginald Denny had his face smashed in by some black protesters.
Oh, that's horrible. Truck driver.
Yeah, I was looking for that corner, but I couldn't find it because my map wasn't good enough. But as I was riding down there, I found that pretty much the whole situation was overplayed by the media. It wasn't like a war zone. Sure, there were some businesses that were looted on the main thoroughfares in South Central LA. But I noticed something very interesting, that whenever you drove by some businesses, they were boarded up, and somebody had spray-painted on them "Black Owner." And on those businesses, they weren't touched at all. But other ones without that designation and without that spray-painting, they were totally looted. So I saw that, the essence of what multiculturalism is. Another thing I saw real early was, what the end result of multiculturalism is about. I was driving through, towns in central California in my early 20s. This is like around 1990, 91. And I drove through towns where every person was a Mexican. Wow. I didn't see a single white person. And that's what multiculturalism's end goal is, although it is often unstated. It is a world without white people.
You had some experiences on the Mexican border as well.
Oh, yes, I have been. Yes, when I was traveling cross-country with the Army, I always took some vacation time to have a little fun when I was driving. And one time I went to El Paso, Texas, which is on the border, as you recall. On the other side of the Rio Grande is the town of Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. And I had to cross in legally, crossing the International Bridge. And I had a good time there for a few hours. Had me a Corona and a real Mexican dinner there. And as I was returning on top of this bridge, which gives you a vantage view of the river, and this river, this so-called Rio Grande, is no more than a big creek, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And it's filled with green water because on the Mexican side, they often dump in raw sewage. And I saw Mexicans wading across it, and on the other side was a gigantic hole, a man-sized hole in the border fence on the American side, and they were just walking through it with no resistance at all. And here I was on the bridge. I had to pay 100 pesos just to get back into the U.S. I had to show my passport and ID, and everything was by the law. And, of course, the INS, which they call ICE now in America, they were, of course, checking all the cars and frisking people and so forth. But down just below this checkpoint on the riverfront, these Mexicans were walking across unencumbered. Nobody was stopping them. It was like single file across the river through this hole. And from high up on that bridge, I could see them walking single file to a large building about a half mile north of there that said, had a giant sign in Spanish that said, Autobuses a Los Angeles. Wow. For those Spanish speakers, that means buses to Los Angeles. There was no police, no INS, nothing stopping them. And this was in the heat of the day, the sun shining, and this was during the presidency of George Bush the First. So any Republican that wants to get on there and say that amnesty is a Democratic thing, it's a total lie, because this was going on right during George Bush's presidency. And if you wanted to go back a few more years to 1983, who was it that signed the first illegal amnesty for illegal aliens? It was Ronald Reagan.
Now, okay, so you saw these fake representatives of whites, and you began searching for genuine white advocacy, and you looked into a few groups, found them wanting. You might name some of those, and then moved on to a more mature.
As I grew up in Virginia, of course there was the KKK in the area, and I mean. What purpose would it serve for me to dress up in a Klan robe as a historical reenactor and burn crosses and do stuff, crazy stuff like that? How is that pushing for a future for white children? And then I came across this World Church of the Creator, and Matt Hale, and I started looking into their literature, and all it is just Hitler worship. You go into their holy books, the White Man's Bible, and Nature's Eternal Religion, and all it talks about is like Hitler, like he's some kind of angel.
I didn't know that. I hadn't read into their literature that much. I suspected them of that. That's why I was never.
And then, do you know that Ben Klassen, the creator of creativity, had a book called Rahoa, This World Is Ours? And if you start reading this book, it's about totally destroying the non-whites and taking over the entire world. I mean, is that feasible?
You're very ambitious, anyway.
It's ambitious, yeah. But the question is it moral?
Insane. Mm.
And
so you started looking into better scholarship, and can you name some of the authors that most inspire you?
Yeah, well, the book that really got me going on the right direction, I read a few years ago. It's Toward the White Republic by Michael O'Meara.
Good one.
And this was the first time that I started thinking about a white republic or a white ethnostate, because up till now, all these other phony conservative groups and phony white nationalist groups talk about is, we got to retake America. We got to get rid of these mud people and whatever. And, I think it's a bit too late, guys. I mean, the last time I checked, there were over 100 million people, non-whites, living in the borders of America. And then they say, come on, Jan, we're still the majority here. Well, that's a lot of bull, guys, because if you look at the 2010 census, it says that the whites are only 62% of the U.S. population. But within that 62%, there's lies, obvious lies. First of all, they allow millions of people from the Middle East and North Africa to identify as white. Yes, my friends, if you read the U.S. Census directions for 2010, it says that if you are from the Middle East or you are from North Africa, you were to identify as white. So that's the first flaw. The second flaw is the undocumented flaw. There are, my friends, 50 million illegal aliens residing within the U.S. right now. Yes, they are undocumented. 50 million, yes.
Because you're talking about demographics, and Arthur Kemp is quite articulate about demographic.
All right, we'll come to Arthur Kemp in a minute.
And that's another one of your influences.
Oh, yes, it definitely is. But reading Michael O'Meara's book, Toward the White Republic, that is what really got me in the mood that we have to set up our own white ethnostates or we will perish, because we white people, or Europids, as I refer to us at United White, and Europid means that specific part of the white race, which is native European, because there are whites who live in Iran or Saudi Arabia or Tunisia. They are whites, according to the U.S. Census.
Caucasians.
And they are not being threatened in any way. They're reproducing fine. But we Europids, or people of European persuasion and character, we are the only group of people in the face of the earth whose numbers are shrinking. They are shrinking because of inadequate reproduction. That means, to put it bluntly, that the current white generation is not producing enough children to replace itself.
Include Eurasians within this definition?
What is a Eurasian?
Well, I would say a Russian is a Eurasian.
I would consider Russians to be Europids. They are Europeans.
Right, but within Russia, you eventually get to a point where you sort of become quite Asiatic in racial influence.
Yeah, I don't consider the Mongolians of the Far East, that's maybe Siberia, to be whites or Europeans. They're not. Mm. Nor do I consider Georgians or Circassians or Abkhazians, you know, all these people in the Caucasus area. They're not.
Yes.
They're not true Europeans. They're white, but they're not Europeans.
There are Europeans who live in the Far East of Russia.
Certainly.
Central Russia, too.
Like in Vladivostok, sure.
Yeah.
But, the more research I did, I found that we are dying of what's called white suicide, because in order for a given people to maintain their numbers from one generation to the next, demographers tell us that each woman has to give birth to 2.1 children. Now, 2.1. Now, doing the research, you find that the highest European reproductive rate is currently in the United States, and we're at 1.84. Mm. Now, if you go to, for example, the European Union as an average is 1.38. If you look at the Czech Republic or the Ukraine, the rate is 1.2. So that's saying that over about 25 to 30 years, the population of the Ukraine and the Czech Republic are going to half themselves because of the lack of reproduction. You gentlemen follow what I'm saying?
Yes. Well, I do.
So while there certainly is an element of white genocide, I mean, our countries are being flooded by, you know, peoples of non-European origin, by traitors within the gates. I mean, this happens in England, where you're at, GW.
Yep.
It's happening here in America. It's happening in Germany, all over. There's a one-way movement of people in this world, and it's from non-white countries into white countries. And it's being done by intention, yeah, by traitors within our gates. And we can talk about who the traitors are, but the plan exists regardless of who they are.
So Amira's book was an important...
It was an eye-opener, because that's when I first understood the need for ethno-states, because if we don't create ethno-states, either by retaking our European homeland or creating European ethno-states somewhere, be it in North America or even in Antarctica, for that matter. Hey, I'd be willing to live there in one. We're going to go extinct. And in the year 2200, the only white people left in this world are going to be those stuffed in an anthropological museum.
Well,
Sorry, go on.
Sorry, I was going to say, we will exist. We will be a rump minority. Some of us, a select few, will be the lower end of the global elites, who have some protection from everything that goes on in the world. But essentially what's being produced over time is something which I think is referred to on in left intellectualism, if you look at Telos or Dissent and that sort of thing, magazines, as the globality. That's this totalistic world of, you know, wage slaves and compliant consumers.
Right. What they're creating, my friends, is they're creating a monoculture. They're trying to breed all of the races of mankind, all of these distinct,
yes,
proud groups of people,
yes,
throughout the world, who I respect all of them. I respect all people who, no matter what their color, who wish to maintain their differences, their,
yes,
culture, their history, their heritage. I support them all. And what this so-called world culture, so-called globalization is doing, it calls itself fraudulently multiculturalism, but what they really want to do is to breed and homogenize everybody into a mocha-colored,
yes,
compliant,
yes,
slave throughout the world.
Personally, I don't think they need to do that. If I was a if these people exist at all, let's get that straight. But if I was a sort of global elite in some smoky room, you know, with my fellow global elites thinking about how I would do this, and let's assume that all of my fellow global elites have got a very good model for this in their religion, okay? If I was going to do that, I wouldn't worry too much about the Chinese, because the Chinese and East Asians generally have a very high conformism factor, and I think that presents as little political problem for somebody aiming to introduce changes of this sort as you're likely to get. So I wouldn't worry about East Asians. I wouldn't worry too much about any country which had a national IQ in the low 80s. So basically India I wouldn't worry about too much. Africa I wouldn't worry about at all. These countries don't present any kind of obstruction to the plan. The only race which presents a real obstruction, because it has such a high sociobiological factor for individualism and for intellect, would be the European race. And I would view this position as saying, well, you know, if you're going to create the globality or, you know, Olam Haba or whatever it is your grand future is, Age of Moshak, then I would definitely be thinking in terms of having to deal with one only. And then, you know, pretty much everything else is under control. You don't have any pressure on time to deal with.
Well, right, there's no question that the European race is the first on their list set for destruction. But after we're destroyed, they're going to cross us off and go for number two. And I think number two is actually the East Asians, like the Japanese. Right now, yes. The countries of East Asia, like Korea, Japan, Taiwan, China, to a certain extent, are also suffering from a lack of birth rates. And look at the kind of Japanese culture they have. In the old days, we had the kamikaze and the martial arts and the samurais. Now look at the modern Japanese men. They're just a bunch of effeminized pansies, and they have this extended adolescence. But, you know, I won't get into that, but I'm just saying that we Europeans are number one on their list set for destruction right now.
I know that GW looks upon Michael O'Meara as one of the best, if not the best, among white nationalists intellectually in America. Yeah.
All right, well, getting back to that book, Toward the White Republic by Michael O'Meara, that was the first book that I read about 4 years ago that really put me in the direction of creating ethnostates. Before that, I had never thought about it. I had gone along with the conservative view of, hey, we just got to take our countries back. It's our country. No, it's not. That's when I started reading Nova Europa by Arthur Kemp. And this book has been the most influential in my thinking up to now, because this book explains that ethnostates are the only way that we are going to preserve our genetic inheritance, that we're going to preserve a future for our children, because right now we are drowning in a sea of immigration, of non-white immigration throughout the European world and all of our nominally white countries, from Britain to Sweden to the USA, for example. Right now, America does not have a European majority anymore. Only in the mainstream media and only on the U.S. Census is that the case, but that's not real. Now, in the other countries of Europe, of Western Europe, they're heading for the same decline within about 30 years. We're already talking in Britain about how, within a certain number of years, by 2066,
It's not 2066. It's much earlier than that. The 2066 date was arrived at by David Coleman. There was another study by Leeds University which dated it. This is the beginning date, the early date, at 2080.
Right.
Now, if you assume, if you take a wry view and you say, well, it's probably worse than they think, so maybe their beginning date is the real date, in each case, fine, you can live with that. But those studies were both based on the 2001 census data, which was
right.
Very flawed, and which also, which for example, I mean, I know at MR, I was actually approached by a demographer. This is when we hadn't been in business very long. We'd only just set up. We created quite a splash when we set up, because we had a unusual crew by intent of conservatives and nationalists. It was my intention to put these people together and see what happened, in the hope that some, I was playing God, some kind of synthesis could occur, and I could learn, you know, how to generate that kind of synthesis in the outside world. So this was what MR was set up to do, and but it certainly struck a nerve at the time, and we got a big readership very quickly. And at that time, we had a very eclectic and broad content as well, which obviously helped. I was contacted by a demographer who's a serious man, who had been himself contacted by the Home Office because they did not have any figures at all for illegal immigrants in the UK, none. And this had suddenly become a hot topic. Sort of the Daily Mail were talking about illegal immigrants, and there's somebody asking questions in the House and this sort of thing. So it was necessary for the Home Office to be able to offer an authoritative reply. And at the time, they couldn't find anybody at all in any of the universities who was not connected in some way or sympathetic towards known by Migration Watch, which was this body had been set up to try to bring some discipline to the whole topic, and who was criticising government, and you know they absolutely hated Migration Watch. So this guy was the only one they could find who wasn't connected. He happened to have been a nationalist by political temper, and he told me this story. So you know these figures. In 2001, that they based these studies on, the 2066 date and the 2080 date, were wholly compromised and allowed absolutely nothing for that. And in fact, what happened was that the Home Office eventually came out with a figure of somewhere in the region of 550,000 illegals thought to be in the country, not included in those studies. And also, that was before Blair and his line of command going down to the Jew Jonathan Fortes within the Home Office Migration Committee, which was incidentally in opening the borders, but before these people actually managed to start the great ingress of foreigners into the country that New Labour achieved, which has had a tremendous effect and may have let in anything up to 7 million people.
Right.
So, you know, those dates, they're not right. The correct date is probably something like 2045.
Okay, well, we're just arguing over dates, GW. The fact is,
but it's very important because it's the difference between one generation and two.
Right. Well, Mr. Kemp is quite correct, and Mr. Kemp is a British gentleman, as you know. He used to live in South Africa until he moved back to Britain, and I think his credentials are very good. But he says that unless we, because of the demographic tide that is happening right now, unless we pro-whites who want a future for our children set up ethno-states, we're frankly going the way of the dinosaurs. We're going extinct.
Yes.
And, you know, extinction is not a moral thing. There's no morality. You can't be moral by being for mass suicide. I mean, mass suicide, as it's being practiced in native white lands right now, is no more moral than the collective suicide committed by Jim Jones' followers in Guyana back in 1979. They drank their Jim Jones Kool-Aid, right, spiked with poison or cyanide. Well, we're drinking it too, and we're saying, oh, we're just so moral because we're letting these poor people in from the third world. And no, committing suicide is never moral.
It isn't suicide.
And,
it isn't suicide, and we shouldn't view it as suicide. The fact that, you know, there's a birth pill, and the fact that feminism exists and has driven women into viewing themselves as career creatures, you know, and the fact that the mortgage or house cost is such that now you've got to have two salaries, and salaries are under pressure all the time every year because of immigration. You work, you know. The fact that this is going on and people can't afford children is not their fault. I think that there are all kinds of problems involved. There's this hyper-individualism.
Well, that's why I say that the term white genocide is properly used in some cases, because
I prefer the term ethnocide, but genocide is applicable.
Okay. Well, there is white ethnocide is a term that does have validity. A lot of people we hear in the white nationalist movement, all they talk about is white genocide and white genocide. But what that does, that makes you be a victim, a cowardless victim who doesn't pay attention to what they're doing themselves. I mean, my case, I didn't get married till I was 30 years old. If I had gotten married in my early 20s, I would have four children instead of two. So part of it is my lifestyle choices. And there are things that we do as individuals that affect our ability to have children. They affect our lifestyle, and we have to take responsibility for them.
Well, I think we have to do all sorts of things, but you need really to affect this, you need to have political power. Because the great issues which bear down on the white family are to do with debt and wage levels and the liberal view of the liberal model of man. I mean, those are the macro features, and one's got to address those because they affect people in the millions. When you're asking somebody to change their lifestyle, you know, be the change you want, sort of thing.
Right.
You're only talking to tens or hundreds, but to really affect a major change, you have to deal at the macro level, at the philosophical level, at the ideological level, and that's the way that you address these things. You would do
so
more.
Hartford Kemp's.
You would do more by succeeding in getting to a position where you could institute positive money, for example, than you would by talking to, for the rest of your life, to a constant line of men and women about their need to have children. and we are engaged as political animals at that higher level in principle, although I do accept that you are, because of the nature of your organization, which I wholly support, I think it's a wonderful thing, that you are you have a slightly different focus. But your organization too, you know, on the website, it's got a page headline philosophy, which is going to be filled out, and that's the big money changer in these kinds of we talk about the generation of a historical event, of a historical change.
Right. Well, if I could jump back into
the
book
Nova
Europa by Arthur Kemp. This is a book that everybody concerned with a white future should read. Nova Europa by Arthur Kemp. You can buy it at Amazon. This book is only 88 pages long, so nobody can plead it's too long to read. You can get through it in a few hours, probably. But what this book will do, will impress on you, is the urgency of the demographic crisis, is that if we do not create European ethno-states, we are going extinct, because right now, as it stands, we Europids are going to lose our homelands. We're going to lose our homeland in England. We're going to lose our homeland in Canada, in U.S., in Germany. I mean, in Germany, for example, they're saying by the year 2050, it will no longer be a German-majority country. So that's not even true. It's probably going to happen before then.
Yes.
So we have to accept the change that is coming, that we are losing our countries. It's just going to happen. And we can't stop it. I mean, voting for UKIP or the BNP or whatever is not going to stop it. So if we want to survive, if a remnant of us wants to survive, we have to create an ethno-state somewhere. And what this book is about is how one creates an ethno-state, how one does it, because it's been done before. For example, in the late 1800s and the 1890s, there was this Jewish crank. He was seen as a crank. Named Herzl, Theodore Herzl, who came up with this crazy idea of creating a Jewish state. And this guy was left out of town by his fellow Jews. He was run out of town, actually, when he tried to set up his first Zionist convention. He was run out of town in Germany by Jews because they thought the idea was so stupid. But about 50 years later, and he died kind of early, mysteriously, but about 50 years later, his dream was took place in Israel with the founding of Israel. So it can be done. And right now, there is Mr. Kemp profiles the town of Orania in the Karoo Desert of South Africa. Mm-hmm. It's a white, sustainable community that's growing very fast. And they're preserving their Afrikaner heritage, their language, and even their genotype by creating this community. So that's another example. So we have to be proactive here and quit talking about this stuff about, come on, we just got to take back our countries.
Yeah.
Well, there's no way. We don't have the numbers. Our people that want this don't have the numbers, because even when a white ethno-state is founded, the majority of whites will never come to it. They will die outside of it, either by childlessness or by death from the violent element of the non-whites, which is happening all over.
But Jan, you're talking like an American, and that's fine for an American. For European, that's something that can only be a provisional position that we can't. If you're an Englishman and an English nationalist, you can't say, oh, well, we're not going to win our country back. You can say, we're not going to win it back for now, and you might take a provisional step back. But you don't as an Englishman accept that you're not going to take your country back.
No.
Well, certainly in the case of Europe, we have a history going back 40,000 years, from what I understand. So,
I understand your position with regard to other continents, but not in Europe.
Right. Because in America, I mean, let's face it, the current wave of white existence here goes back to Jamestown, and that was only in 1607. That was only, what, 407 years ago. So that's nothing compared to 40,000 years.
Right.
But these are things that we have to consider. We have to consider creating ethnostates so that we have a chance to regroup and to get our reproductive rates up.
But what you're talking about basically is an ethnostate in on the American soil, and presumably the one that's most accepted for that is in the Northwest. Is that something that you would support?
Well, I'm for the promotion of all white ethnostates, for that matter, but I think that Nova Acadia is a better proposal, because if you look at the states, the U.S. states of Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, plus the English-speaking Canadian Maritime provinces of Nova Scotia, and what are the other ones? Help me out, guys, here.
Nova Scotia. I've never been to Canada.
Okay, well, if you look at that English-speaking area, collectively speaking,
it's Asianizing,
transcends both U.S. and America, the population there currently is 98% white and 88% agrarian at present. So that's an ideal place.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really know much about Harold Covington's Northwest Front. I've listened to a few of his podcasts. At least the guy has the right idea. He's putting out the need for an ethnostate, because we're not going to survive under the current paradigm.
No.
I mean, it's going to be hell for our children before they're killed. And if you think the American Indian got a raw deal here in America under multiculturalism, and that's what it was. It was multiculturalism that killed the Indian. Well, at least he got some reservations out of the deal. Well, what is being planned for us Europids here in America is worse than that. It's total destruction, and you don't get your reservations.
Okay, so the next book that was very influential to you is Greg Johnson's
Old Right versus New Right by Greg Johnson. And Greg Johnson has a PhD in philosophy, so he has his background is in the right direction to be able to discuss all of these issues. This is a book of essays. It's about 40 essays in it on various topics regarding our current struggle. And Dr. Johnson is certainly for an ethnostate. He talks about it in many places. He calls it the White Republic. I guess that's because his Countercurrents Publishing is also the publisher of Michael Mura's Toward the White Republic. So he's totally on board with the idea of that. And this book has really straightened out my thinking into what ethno-nationalism is.
And it's something that we can coordinate on, that we could all potentially agree upon, which is one of my central concerns, getting us to work in the same direction, not integrating to where we're just one mass of people indistinct of our ancient kinds, but on the other hand, not fighting one another, fighting against our common enemies. So there are a few more things that you might want to say about Greg Johnson's perspective on that until we get to what I see as the next problem for uniting whites, or coordinating them, as I prefer to say, which is all this Hitler advocacy in white nationalism. But what more might you say about Greg Johnson's book to begin?
Well, I would certainly recommend that anybody who is concerned with a future for Europids, us white people, read this book, because it's trying to modernize the message and to put it into a moral way. See, it's immoral, like the World Church of the Creator, to say, Rahoa, this world is ours. No, it's not ours. We white people are Europids. We are just part of creation. We're part of the biosphere. The other races exist, and they have as much of a right to exist and persist in the future as we do.
And that book by Johnson, it also shows him kind of turning around on the Hitler issue, because one of the things that turned me off to Johnson to begin with was some of his pro-Hitlerism, and in that book he seems to indicate that some of Hitler's policies were not ethno-nationalist, and he can't abide them, that they were imperialistic, but that was something of what he would call the old right, and he's trying to distinguish himself from.
Well, exactly. I mean, the first essay in his book is called Old Right versus New Right, and that really explains what the difference is. And maybe I'll just take a minute just to read a page or two out of this book here about this. What is new about the North American New Right, and how does it relate to the Old Right? Before I can answer that, I need to clarify what the Old Right and the New Right have in common, and what differentiates them from today's phony right, namely the present-day center-right parties and all forms of classical liberalism. The true right, in both its old and new versions, is founded on the rejection of human equality as a fact and as a norm. The true right embraces the idea that mankind is and ought to be unequal, i.e. differentiated. Men are different from women. Adults are different from children. The wise are different from the foolish. The smart from the stupid. The strong from the weak. The beautiful from the ugly. We are differentiated by race, history, language, religion, nation, tribe, and culture. These differences matter, and because they matter, all of life is governed by real hierarchies of fact and value, not by the chimera of equality. The true right rejects egalitarianism root and branch. The true right has three species: traditional society, the old right, and the new right. Every traditional society known to man is inegalitarian. All forms of traditional society have been destroyed, or are in the process of being destroyed, by modern egalitarian mass society. For our purposes, the old right means fascism, national socialism, and other national populist movements, which are the preeminent attempts to restore traditional hierarchical social forms within the context of modernity. Fascism and national socialism were not merely reactionary rear guard resistances to modern egalitarianism by partisans of corrupt hierarchies. They represented a genuinely revolutionary impetus to restore vital, archaic, hierarchical values within the context of modern science, technology, and mass society. The new right and old right share the same goal, a society that is not just hierarchical, but also organic, a body politic, a racially and culturally homogeneous people, a people that is one in blood and spirit, a people that is politically organized and sovereign, and thus in control of its own destiny. Our ideal is a hierarchical society free of exploitation and injustice, because the sole justification of political inequality is the common good of the body politic, not the factional good of the ruling stratum. So how does the new right differ from fascism and national socialism? This is a vital question because of the intense stigmas attached to these movements since the Second World War. The North American New Right, like the European New Right, is founded on the rejection of fascist and national socialist party politics, totalitarianism, terrorism, imperialism, and genocide. The North American New Right is a new movement. We do not have any thinkers of the caliber of Alain de Benoist, Guillaume Fay, and many others. We are deeply indebted to the decades of work they have done. But since North America differs from Europe, our approach differs as well in three important ways. And I'll stop there.
Well, you could have read on, but it would be leading into next week's interview, whatever it is, when we eventually do it, sometime in December, with Greg.
Yeah, so we're all for ethnic nationalism, but we've got this...
We haven't said what it is.
We have to understand, to let the audience know, that ethno-nationalism just means that all peoples throughout the world should be allowed to preserve their uniqueness, what differentiates them, their culture, their genotype, their history, their traditions, and left unencumbered to pursue their fate. There's no need to appeal to supremacist thought, because if you look at it, I'm a biologist in my training, and I value all of the species on this earth as they exist. I mean, right now we say that 200 species are going extinct every day. Well, we white people or Europids are a subspecies of the Caucasian race, which is a subspecies of Homo sapiens, and we are worth protecting just because we are part of nature.
Yeah.
This is page 14 of the foreword in the very front, and he defines these terms. Ethno-nationalism is the idea that every distinct ethnic group should enjoy political sovereignty in an ethnically homogeneous homeland or homelands. Yeah. The opposing view is multiculturalism, which holds that multiple ethnic groups should share the same homelands and governments.
Yes.
So obviously, ethno-nationalism is a moral principle, because it says that everybody, whether you're Kurds or Iranians or Tibetans or even us Europeans, we should enjoy political sovereignty and an ethnically homogenous homeland or homelands. There's nothing wrong about this because it doesn't infringe on the rights of others.
We can basically agree that ethno or ethnic nationalisms are something that we want to pursue in one way or another and coordinate. I've observed that something that's flying in the face of that, which is the popularity of Hitler in so many white nationalist sites. Now, I think that Jan is saying that Hitler was not an ethno-nationalist, but nevertheless, he's popular on Renegade, he's popular on the Daily Stormer, he's popular on American Nationalist Network, he's popular with the Stormfront people, he's obviously Carolyn Jaeger, and many others. And it seems so obvious that Hitler's not someone we can unite under, that he's going to create antagonism between Europeans of necessity, whereas we could be at least not interfering with each other and perhaps even aligning against our common antagonists and enemies, which we should. I mean, recently this article from Haaretz was discussed that Polish youths were somehow 50% of them were looking at pro-Hitler sites, and this is cited as if Hitler advocacy it's winning, it's futile to contest. It's like, this is absurd, as if we should just take for granted the Jewish definition of what a pro-Hitler site is, as if we understand what the people who are going to those Hitler sites are looking for. I go to Hitler sites sometimes. Everybody knows that I'm not pro-Hitler.
How much does it correlate with the concern about Jewish power and Jewish influence in America, right? And the German factor?
Let me relate an anecdote. I taught a year at the university, at a university here, and I stood before my class and I tried to explain the perils of blacks to them as I sheepishly got into that, as to distinguish it from what they see on TV. And someone from my class piped up and said, "We hate Jews." I was flabbergasted. I couldn't believe what I hear in a college classroom to hear this. And just, you know, nobody's saying a word, you know, just like, oh, nobody's shocked or objecting, just plainly taken for granted. So, and yet at the same time, I know that they're not pro-Hitler. The point that I'm making is I don't think that Americans understand Eastern Europe and the nationalisms here. I don't think that they understand how Ukrainian nationalism was anti-Soviet and anti-Jewish in essence. They don't understand that Polish nationalism was anti-Soviet and anti-Jewish in essence, and they definitely don't know that about Belarusian nationalism being anti-Jewish and anti-Soviet in essence. And of course, there's Russian as well nationalism that's anti-Soviet and anti-Jewish. And so they just gloss over this. The white nationalists do in America. They revert from the pro-Jewish position to the pro-Hitler position. They run roughshod over these ethno-nationalisms between what was the Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany, as if it's a grand either or, and it's troubling. There's a lot of understanding that needs to be achieved before we're going to get anywhere.
Well, I guess my take on it, gentlemen, is that the image of Hitler that is perceived by the white nationalists is a flawed image. Yes, sure, in Germany he did remove Judaic influence from his country. He removed them from banking and education, college professorships, and the various trades. And he, with his transfer agreements, he was actually helping to set up the State of Israel. Although I don't think the Israelis would admit that. But if you read the book 51 Documents, it's written by a Marxist Jew. I can't recall his name. He's a college professor. Lenny Brenner, B-R-E-N-N-E-R, Lenny Brenner, 51 Documents. You will find all of the documents relating to Nazi Germany and the Zionists. So you know, Hitler was very instrumental in founding this country. And actually, in the 60s, a Jew by the name of Henneke Kardel, and that's spelled K-A-R-D-E-L, wrote a book called Adolf Hitler, Founder of Israel. It's a very controversial book you should read. It was eye-opening for me. So yes, Hitler was instrumental in removing Judaics from positions of influence in German-occupied Europe. But what the white nationalists and the neo-Nazis fail to understand or even aware of is Hitler's policies toward the Slavs of the East. Hitler wasn't just about, you know, fixing some territorial injustices out of the Versailles Treaty. He was about taking over all of Eastern Europe and turning it into a German area. And if I could just take a minute to read you a very important part from a book called Hitler, Study of a Revolutionary, by Martin Housden. That's H-O-U-S-D-E-N. Mr. Housden writes on page 138, quote, "There was a savage irony here. The Eastern peoples, and especially non-Russians, often welcomed the Germans with open arms. They saw them as liberators from Soviet oppression."
That's the part I don't like, but the rest of it is good.
Okay, all right, you can object. "Often, only communists fled before German troops, and industrial complexes were taken over undamaged. All that would have been necessary for a successful occupation would be a soft hand and a soft word. Instead, and on Hitler's direct instructions, the war in the East was pursued with the utmost barbarity. Once Barbarossa was underway, extensive plans were drawn up for the Germanization of vast tracts of the East. Most famous among these was General Plan East, or as we call it in German, Generalplan Ost. It was written by the Reich Secretary Head Office at the end of 1941 as a plan for the Germanization of the whole of the East, the Baltic states, Poland, Czechoslovakia, the Ukraine, and White Ruthenia. The plan was to be enacted over 20 years or so, but also foresaw the whole area up to the Urals becoming populated by 600 million Germans in a matter of centuries. There were plans to sift through the eastern populations to find individuals suitable for Germanization, but still it was assumed that between 40 and 45 million Slavic people would be removed from Europe, one way or another, to make way for the settlement of Germans. Their people were to be derived from the following sources: 3.8 million from Germany itself, 100,000 from resettlement camps, 500,000 from ethnic German communities scattered throughout southern Europe, 150,000 from ethnic German communities in northern Europe, 750,000 Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians, and Goralians, who were all to be Germanized, plus 150,000 Germans who were expected to return from overseas, for example, the USA. A plan such as this could only have been developed under the patronage of Adolf Hitler. Its scope was too great for anything else." End of quotes.
Right, and Jan and I opened up the PDF of Hitler's table talk, and all you have to do is search Urals, and you'll come to Hitler's plans to take Europe up to the Urals and his ambitions to do so.
And to Germanize
Ukraine. Or Ukraine, if you search Ukraine, you come up to his plans for Ukraine. Those Eastern Europeans that were applauding Hitler were doing so rather naively. But but it's important for people to understand that these nationalisms, Belarus, Ukraine, and Poland, between Germany and the Soviet Union, were so anti-Soviet. Pilsudski had already defeated the Soviets, in fact, on their way to Russia, and so this was in the fiber of their nationalism to be against the Soviets. Therefore, it belies the argument that Hitler had to do this for defensive reasons, because if these nationalisms had been allowed to flourish and been encouraged and fostered, they would have fought the Soviets off of their own accord. And,
of course.
And anybody attacking Germany would have been totally crazy. Then it comes down to just four cities that Hitler was had contention over with after the Treaty of Versailles: Poznan, Bydgoszcz, Torn, and Danzig. And a war like that for those four cities is an absurdity. So these arguments that white nationalists are making are very shoddy. I mean, Yes, it would have been difficult to coordinate these nationalisms. They were fighting each other.
Well, if I
but
could,
it would have been no harder than what happened.
Right. Mr. Housden in that passage is very correct. All that would have been needed was a soft hand and a soft word. But let's look at what happened with Ukraine, for example.
With one caveat, you're going over the whole nation of Poland when you're talking about cooperating with Ukraine at that point. But okay, go on.
But Stepan Bandera in Lvov set up a provisional government after the Germans invaded that was anti-Bolshevik, anti-Soviet. So what did Hitler do? Instead of letting these people rule and take over power and create goodwill toward Germany, he had them sent to Germany and sent to concentration camps. So Hitler was not an ethno-nationalist. He just believed in running over the Slavic peoples. He did not treat them as fellow white brothers and sisters. He treated them as inferiors.
He was a racial supremacist.
He was a German supremacist.
Well,
and
I think it was a bit broader than that. I mean, I think he had respect for Nordics. I think he had respect for the English, actually.
And the French.
I'm not sure about the French. I don't think he did too much. Maybe in the north. But I don't think he gave a damn about the Italians that he cooperated with. But that was just his cast of mind, and as you say, it had nothing whatsoever to do with a generous and sort of universal style of nationalism of the kind that you've been talking about.
Right.
Which I think is the only moral basis for any people, European or otherwise, to actually say, well, you know, we too must have a place on this earth.
Right. This is what distinguishes Adolf Hitler from the real white uniter, King Jan Sobieski III. And that's where my moniker, Jan the White Uniter, comes from. Because if you refer to what happened in 1683, that was the Battle of Vienna.
Yes.
I mean, since the fall of Constantinople, the Turks, the Ottomans, have been gradually inching their way up southeastern Europe, going through Serbia, Croatia, then Budapest and Hungary fell. And soon, the Turks were facing Vienna. And the crowned heads of Europe knew that if Vienna fell, it was over for Europe. Well, there was one man, King Jan III Sobieski of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And back in those days when he lived, and let me get the birth dates for Jan Sobieski, if you'd like, here. He was born in Olesko, which is now in the Ukraine, in 1629. So this is like he was born about 20 years after the founding of Jamestown in America. Yeah. So what happened was he was a great Polish commander, and back in those days, Poland and Lithuania were united under one country, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And they had kings that were elected by the Diet. You had to be king, you had to be a great military commander, and that's how he became king. Well, in 1683, as the Turks were ready to roll over Vienna, and all of Europe was fretting and fearing for their lives, this man came together and said, look, we got to stop this. We have to come together as one and drive these bastards out of our continent. So it was Jan Sobieski, Jan the White Uniter, the original White Uniter, who led the joint forces of Poland, Austria, and Germany. And in 1683, they soundly kicked the Turks out of Vienna. And that was the end for the Ottoman Empire in Europe. Gradually, the Europeans started conquering back their territory. So that's who Jan Sobieski was. He was a man who could speak several languages, as I can myself. He was a man who had a French wife. He had traveled all over Western and Eastern Europe as a young man, meeting with crown heads and the potentates and statesmen of the area. So he was totally aware of the great, powerful mosaic of European culture. And that's what he wanted to preserve. He wanted it all preserved as it was, not trying to blend it all together, like Hitler did.
Okay, well, look, Jan, we've got to the point where I think we need to finish on up note, and it seems to me that the best way to do that is to set Mr. Hitler and all of that strife to one side, because it's such a dull, grey issue, heavy on the heart.
And it's divisive.
And it's an obstruction.
Yes.
So let's look at this thing from a much more hopeful perspective. You are doing something which I hugely respect. It was something I thought of in a different way of doing myself a few years ago. So I wanted to talk to you when what your project was introduced to me by Daniel, chiefly for that reason. I wanted to ask you how you thought you could make this thing grow, how you would reach out, how you saw a flowering of this gradually developing into other things. So, you know, how do you see what you're starting here moving forward, and what do you see it delivering? Can you finish us up on that?
Well, what I'm doing is essentially metapolitical. Metapolitics is what must be the precursor for actual political action in the future. And metapolitics has two, as Mr. Johnson describes it, has two features. One is educational and propaganda. We have to keep putting it out. But secondly, it's about organization. And what I want to do is I want to create an organization, a professional, pro-white, international organization that's ethno-nationalist, where we can all come together as one to organize ourselves. Because the reason that Judaics have so much power, they are the predominant influence in our native white countries at present, is because they are the most organized people in the face of the earth. I mean, they have literally hundreds or thousands of organizations that represent all of their various cultural ideas and political extremes and whatever. And how many do we have? How many organizations in America or in England do we have that represent the interest of decent white people? The answer is zero, and that's why we have no political power, and that's why we're losing our countries on a daily basis. It's because of a lack of organization. So once you understand that power, political power, comes from organization, then you want to start organizing. And what I want to do is create a professional organization that's open to Europeans all over the world, United White, where we have certain first of all, goals. We have goals. If you read the goals on the website, please go to unitedwhite.org and read about our goals. We have concrete goals. We have standards of behavior. To be a member, you have to act a certain way. You have to be white and normal. And this is why it's important, because there are millions, tens of millions of white people in America and probably in Middle England as well that have had it with their dispossession. They're losing their jobs. They're being demoted from the middle class to the pauperhood. And they're losing everything as we speak. But they won't come out, and they won't come out and join crazy people wearing swastikas and Nazi outfits and Klan uniforms and whatever other circus workers there are out there. They're not going to come out. They're only going to come out and join people who are professionals, who know how to act normal, behave normal, and dress normal. And that's what United White is about. If you want to say that's elitist, well, so be it. A revolutionary cadre has to be elitist to start with, you know, in terms of thinkers. So what we're doing is we're trying to come together and work on common goals and organization. And the first thing I want to stress is that we white people, we Europids, have legitimate interests that do not infringe on the rights of other peoples. That's ethno-nationalism. And secondly, we want to develop a positive sense of community that exists throughout the Europid diaspora, wherever it exists, like where I'm at in Australia, England, you name it. And also then we want to come together with the idea that we're going to need ethno-states to survive this coming century. It's just a fact. We can sit around and talk this bull about how we can take back our countries, but it's not in the works for right now. Maybe in the future, perhaps, but we need to regroup and come together and form ethno-states, or we're going the way of the dinosaurs.
Yeah. Very good.
But that's still not quite a positive ending. It's still, you know, the thing is that reaction, because it carries such a charge of anger and powerlessness, you know, raging at the dying light, this sort of thing, it's not necessarily the best way to reach out. Now, what National Socialists achieved was using some very basic methods, kinds of methods that we don't have, the levels of organization that we don't have, the levels of reception that we don't have, but they gave hope to people.
Let me say one thing about that before I forget. The Hitler talk with Jan that I've engaged in here is very important in the context of white nationalism now. Why I wanted to have you talk with Metzger wasn't so much for theoretical reasons, but because he does try to dissuade people from Hitler. So right now, with all these Daily Stormers being, for example, so popular, that
there's a positive program there, Daniel? As I was just saying to Jan, we've got a very clear statement from him there which is reactive and which is essentially a cry from the heart. But that doesn't necessarily provide people with a way forward. This is about the naturalistic fallacy. You can say, well, look, there's this disaster here. But it's not so straightforward to then say, and there's this action there. These two don't necessarily have a connection. You have to make a switch and produce a optimistic, colourful, life-giving, vivifying course of action. And this is what I'm saying about the National Socialists. There's one particular picture on the internet which I've seen a very few times, and I've searched for it because I think it's such a wonderful piece of photojournalism. And it's obviously of a crowd being controlled by very few soldiers, and they're all waiting clearly for, you know, the car to drive by. And in it, they clambered up lampposts. They're absolutely ordinary Germans. They're roistering around everywhere. And there's this tremendous enthusiasm which is overtaking everybody, overtaking the soldiers. You know, it's huge. And you can see that this, multiplied across the German nation, would be the most immense generator of healthy action. And what you have to find a way of bringing in. So, you know, this I say to Jan is that you can't do this simply by stating the is and then expect there to be a should. You've got to do much more to arrive at this tremendously optimistic appetite for change, to actually be the change you seek, and to make the thing push forward like a flood that knocks down everything in its path and changes the whole landscape. That is what we're actually seeking to engender, and but National Socialism did do that, and that's my expectation as to why it was so powerful in its time and why its echoes are still hold a lot of people in awe, especially amongst German Americans.
Hitler sincerely loved the German people, and he was concerned about them in infinite detail and all that. You know, I could understand how people could be swept up in appreciation for him as at the time. I mean, loving Germany was the same as loving Hitler, the way he was.
Yes, but this is one of the Jewish ideas that came into National Socialism. It's just the Führer principle.
It was the racial supremacism. It comes out of Judaism.
Yes,
it comes out of specifically the Zadokite cult of Judaism. Not the Hebrews in general, but the Zadokites. And they are the ones who first came up with this idea that they were a part of humanity separate from the rest, with the right to rule over and hegemonize the rest. So what Hitler did is he just took these ideas, these Semitic ideas, and he transferred them to the Germans.
Correct. Three in particular: supremacism, the Führer principle, and millenarianism, the thousand-year Reich. Those are the three grand concepts that he took. And if you look at what National Socialism is actually built on, there's actually only about seven or eight clearly definable principles. So, you know, three of them for sure are of Semitic origin. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all just he basically Judaized the Germans. That's he took these Judaic ideas of racial supremacy.
And that's what the militarization and the uniform and the rest of it was for. It was saying, I too am a Jew. Look, I am not myself. I am not wearing my work clothes. I am not a farmer in the field. Actually, I am this shining creature, this perfect being who has a perfect soul. And look, you can see the shining creature through the lapels of my uniform. And that's really a large part of it. And if you look at the success of that, you know, in terms of the way it motivated people, it's pretty bloody depressing. But nonetheless,
I could give my answers as to what would inspire people. I have some things in mind, but this is about Jan right now.
Well, it's quite obvious, gentlemen, that if we continue doing what we're doing, and we have various white groups out there of some sorts, various flavors. But they're all kind of doing their own thing. They're zigging and zagging, and there's no coordination. And if I gave you a football analogy of two football teams, as an Englishman, this would be very popular. Let's say that team one has a very strong, insightful coach. He's very powerful, and they review past games on video, and they see what their mistakes were, and they don't make them again. All of the players know how to communicate well with each other in language and in gestures. and they know what they're doing. They're working as one. That's team one. Team two is a bunch of people without a coach, and they don't know how to play the game. They don't really have any strategy, and they just do what they want. Well, which team is going to win? It's obvious that team one is going to win, because when you're organized, only when you're organized can you have victory. And right now in America, we have the National Socialist Movement, the Northwest Front, the KKK. I could just go down the list. What do these groups have in common? Nothing. Do they have a common goal? No. They can't even come together and have three or four common goals.
The team analogy, John, is a good one.
Well, look, Jan, thank you very much.
All right.
For a very interesting conversation. I think that Daniel likes to try to keep in touch with everybody we speak to, and you know, it may be that there are some things that we can do to help you with what you're doing, and it would be certainly a privilege to be involved in any way with a movement of the kind which you are commencing, and I wish you all the very best of luck with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.